Welcome back, listeners, to Built to Lead Season 4, Rebels with a Cause. Today, we'll continue our second half of our discussion with Dr. Roberta Timothy. Dr. Timothy is the Black Health Lead at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto and founder of the Masters of Public Health in Black Health, who started its inaugural cohort in September of 2023. In part two, we'll be discussing two articles today with Dr. Timothy. The first will be about the importance of providing Black mentorship in residency programs, and the second article looks at and is discussing the different dimensions of inclusive leadership. Stay tuned to hear what Dr. Timothy has to share with us.
You know, when we think about a forest, if we're looking at it, it starts with one tree.
Yep.
That tree produces fruits.
Yep.
It comes down, the seeds go in. So talking about good trouble, RP to like John Lewis.
Yeah.
That's a legacy that 100%. Continues. So even just start of this program, this is another legacy. So we can't expect the big change to happen overnight, but as we see like the power of a forest, the beauty of the forest and nature, this is something that we're trying to build over time. And part of that is done through education, because I do believe education is key.
Yeah.
That's something that in my family, something we always talked about, something I do believe in.
Yeah.
And education is critical in fostering these platforms
and
making those groundworks in which we cultivate good rebel tendencies. So programs like this will help to build those leaders to create those safer spaces in healthcare for health and wellness. And education also is a time for mentorship.
Yes.
And mentorship during education brings us actually to the article we want to actually talk to you today about. Mm-hmm. And for our listeners, as always, you can find the links to the PDFs in our articles in the episode description. And if you would like to read them yourself or reference them later, but we will summarize for you as we go. The first article we want to talk to you about is by Onape Egbidi and the Black Physicians of the Canada Research Group, which comes from the Canadian Medical Association Journal. And it really talks about the criticality of providing Black mentorships in Canadian residency programs. We do know that Black medical learners are underrepresented, and there's a historical systemic barriers that cause this. As more Black trainees enter into the health system, we're going to need more Black mentors to help them navigate these race-related issues and facilitate their career advancement. And while Black medical mentorship is available, it is dramatically less so at the residency stage. So to combat this, we have the Black Physician of Canada, who built a membership program in 2021 to help combat this. So the article focused on the criticality of racial concordant mentorship. When this is not available within our organizations, how can we go about finding mentors?
I think this is a really important question, and the article is a really powerful one, and not only talks about the challenges of having Black physicians, right? Having, like, we don't have a representation in terms of Black physicians, and there are new programs that are trying to change this. But even when we look at what to have mentorship, how do we get Black mentorship for folks in residency? And I think it's also mentorship for Black students, and also mentorship in terms of resisting anti-Black racism for other, you know, other students or other students in residency. I think that we have to really look into the community also. I think we already know that, you know, we do have many numbers of doctors who are trying to mentor students and being a part of it. I think that we need to access the, you know, Black physicians that we have in terms of their knowledge and their skills, and even having more symposiums and more mentoring opportunities. But I also think we need to also look into our elders in the community who have gone through different aspects of work and, you know, who are there and available to mentor students. You know, if we looked at the population of Black folks, Black seniors who have, they're in healthcare and not in healthcare, but I think they have some really good information for us. For me, education has never been about being in a classroom only, right? It's really about community engagement. So, you know, what's happening to the folks in the community? What's happening in terms of the movements that are happening, you know, in terms of, you know, against racial profiling, or how to support, there's a lot of food security programs or food insecurity programs kind of, you know, supporting mentorship with how do you grow food that is good for us or well for us. So I think that there needs to be an expansion in what we think about leadership for Black medical students. And I would agree that mentorship is critical for survival. It allows people to see themselves. But I also think that it needs to come from outside of the medical school also. I think that we need to make sure that we are creating anti-racist and anti-oppression mentorship for Black doctors. So to look at ways of challenging exclusion, challenging some of the biases that happen within medical schools. And I think that we need a variety of village folk to support in that growth, right? I think it has to come from the social workers, the community organizers, the healers, the creators, the artists, you know, the poets in the community, and trying to create an inclusive leadership that embraces those dimensions that you talked about: visual commitment, humility, awareness of bias, curiosity, but others. I think that we do that in a very transgenerational way within the Black community, and I hope that that's something that can be utilized. I actually have worked a lot with doctors and medical students, and I really think that even I teach a course on intersectionality. And even that course, there's a lot of medical students are taking this course that I do. It's a summer course on intersectionality, inequity, and public health. And they're wanting to understand really Black feminist thought, because that's where intersectionality comes from, and want to understand how they can practice it in their work. So I think for mentoring Black medical students, I think we need to support folks to be grounded in their identities, to be proud of who they are, and to understand what tools that they need to combat anti-Black racism and other forms of violence, that they will meet in a system that has not included us, or a system that has not treated us always well.
Yeah, I agree. And definitely does take a village. Even just thinking back to my own personal experience, just like how you were 3 years talking about where's the Black bus drivers?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And I had when I went to the hospital or I had certain appointments, I was like, wait, where's the Black CO leaders? Where are the Black leaders? So those are things that are missing. And then even just thinking about the mentorship piece, even outside of physicians, whether you're Black, white, Asian, finding the mentorship within, let's say, your culture and outside of it, I think that is important. And as you talk about, your community needs to help expose you to these different opportunities. Because for myself, I always had a dream of, or a goal of getting to health leadership. And this is something that no one in my family has necessarily done. So for me to get into this, it was very hard. So luckily, I did have people within my family or network to kind of introduce me to other folks to help me along my journey. But it would have been a lot easier if I had somebody in the community that knew this knowledge that I could go to, that could share with me.
And that's why the sharing of it, once you have it, right, it's like we have to share it. It's exactly. And that's a part of it. You know, I come from a family, very poor family outside of Canada back home. And, you know, we came here working class. My mom came here as a domestic worker. She went back to school at 40 and, you know, became did women's studies and became a social worker and had 4 kids, you know, all of these stories. And then she gave us that mentorship. Mm-hmm. And I was around a community of folk doing it. And then it's now it's me doing it and other folk. And then, you know, I'm raising my children to do it. Right. And they have to. So we have to be able to give back. It's a part of if we're going to do anti-racist, anti-oppression work, if we're really going to change this system, if we're really going to make equity and wellness and healing a part of our lives, right, a part of our goal, then we have to give back, and we got to take care of ourselves, too. Yep. Taking care of ourselves. If we don't have anything to give, then you can't give, right? It becomes flat. So it's really such an important gift. I feel like it's a gift to do, to be in health leadership, particularly when there's not a lot of us. It's a gift, not a gift that we're fighting, you know, we're fighting the system, but it's a gift that you have the power, you have power to make changes, and what you say and do makes a difference for our community. So it's really amazing to even hear your journey and to see what you're going to do next, you know?
And you talk about the gift of giving back and sharing. And I think that's very important in terms of the struggle that we may face. Mm-hmm. So even in the book, The Rebel Talents, Jean also talks about how when we're aware of stereotypes and when they're acting against us and we act with courage, how do we act with courage and not let them control us? So this way we can better produce better outcomes for ourselves. And Gino also talks about the story of Ava DuVernay, the filmmaker behind the Oscar-winning Selma, also When They See Us, a very impactful film. She didn't have any mentors. She didn't have any connections. And she did this in quote-unquote later in her life, I'd say in her 30s, mm-hmm. where most people start earlier. Mm-hmm. But despite all this, she was able to succeed. So it's especially important to just be mindful of some of these stereotypes that are acting against us
100%.
When we don't have these mentors on our side. And I'm pretty sure, I know you get this question a lot, and as someone who has succeeded despite all the barriers that are in place, how do you psych yourself up, mentally prepare, or deal with these challenging stereotypes? I know you said one time in an interview, resiliency is 365 days a year, 24 hours every day for a lifetime.
Yeah.
I could definitely attest to that. So like, how do we go through this if we know the struggle is an everyday struggle?
Such a good question. And I do get this a lot. And I think about this a lot too, because I think about the impact of having to deal with, you know, racist violence on a daily basis and other forms of violence. So one thing, people say, you know, I've succeeded. It makes me think about what that actually means. I don't see myself as succeeding, because when my community is harmed and being harmed, I'm still a part of it, right? So I see myself as, yes, I've moved through, and I, as I said, I come from a working class background. I come from poor folk. And I say that purposely, I say that because what the discrimination, the stereotypes, the barriers that existed and still exist for me to move through were challenging. They're really challenging. And they had an impact. And I think that when we see people on the other side, sometimes we're like, if there's another side, if we dichotomize this, we're like, wow, that person made it. Look at them. You know, I got a PhD, I got a lot of degrees. Yes, it's true. I owed a lot of money because I didn't come from money, right? I think one thing for me was the self-care and the community care. And I saw many folks who were dealing with racism and other forms of violence, dealing with really serious mental health and physical health outcomes. And I saw that very early on in the various movements that I was in. And that's why I kind of decided to actually go into like counseling and psychotherapy and wellness work. And, you know, the anti-oppression psychotherapy model that I developed was based on that, was really based on seeing people in the community doing amazing resisting work, anti-racist, anti-oppression work, but really having physical and mental health challenges as a result. So I think for me, getting my mental health in check, you know, physically, I was an athlete for many years. I lost my sight, but still was an athlete for, you know, I was a long jumper of basketball for 22 years I did track for. And having some outlet, right, outlet to deal with the impact of the violence on me mentally and physically was really important. I also am a very spiritual person. And, you know, for me, ancestors having, you know, conversation talks and time alone to be able to assess what I'm doing was really important for me moving through. But I want to say that I have days that are like, what's going on? I have days that I don't feel good about this work and about the change that's happening, the slowness of it. You know, the song that Nina Simone sings, Mississippi, Goddamn. The basis of the song is they want folks to slow down in terms of doing, you know, anti-racist work or anti-colonial work. So I have those days of like, what's happening with me? How do I move through? And then I take my time. I take some time. I do different things to be able to get back to being able to lead and being able to lead fiercely and unapologetically in an anti-racist and anti-oppression way. But we're human. I'm a human being, right? So I have my moments when, you know, being followed at the store for the fifth time, you know, or somebody giving change to me not in my hand as a grown woman, or being called something derogatory is, you know, gets to me. So I have to have those movements. That's when I call my girlies. I have my group, my sisterhood, friendships that make me be able to come back and move through and then come back and do the work. So I don't know if what I do is successful. What I know is what I'm doing is a part of the resistance movement for our communities. And I'm trying to continue to be a part of a larger movement that has been operating for over 400 years to try to do resistance-centered work. It's an everyday thing. It hurts sometimes really, really, really bad. Sometimes you have some of the most joyous moments and laughs and jokes. You just have to laugh because there's so much foolishness happening. And then you start again and you continue on. I don't know if I answered the question, but that's kind of how I think about what you asked.
I think you did answer it. And you even talk about resistance. I'm just thinking about like resistance training as well. So If you have that progress in the gym over time, it does hurt, but then you'll see that change in you. So success, sometimes we always think about this endpoint, but it is about a journey. So I kind of like how the way you said it. So It's good that you're not complacent, and that resistance and that really that movement you talked about, it should continue and move forward.
Building anti-racist, anti-oppression leadership is really building a muscle, right? You got to build that muscle. Exactly. And then that muscle needs to rest sometimes, right? Because you worked it too much. Yep. And sometimes you need to, you know, it needs to shine and to be big and to move, and you can do a lot of things. So
what was an interesting moment of reflection for me while you were sharing was when you shared that, you know, you definitely need self-care and to focus on your mental health.
Yeah.
But don't think that the self-care is only you working to better your own mental health.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yes, 100%.
Right? So although we call it self-care, I think you also, as when you said that, you also kind of supplemented that by, I need to go back to my elders.
Yes.
To get that quote unquote self-care.
Yep.
Right? So it's more of a community effort to mentally prepare to tackle challenge rather than you sitting somewhere and getting that yourself, that rejuvenation, that energy yourself, and then going back out and tackling those specific things. So
totally.
It was an interesting take that you just shared.
It's self-care and community care. Yourself, you're connected to community. You can't, it's not separated. This is not
100%.
Right? So your care is your, if you're caring for yourself, it's for you to continue to support your community. And your community care is making sure that people have access to mental health resources that are like culturally safe, that are culturally just, right? That can support you to be able to support yourself, to be able, and their communities, to move through to the other side, right? To the, you know, So it's village.
I love
village.
That. Yeah.
Still village.
Yeah, the momentum of the concept of village love remains strong in our conversation.
Yes. Has to be.
100%. So I wanna try to kind of dive deeper into the second article now by Juliette Burke and Andrea Titus, which comes to us from the Harvard Business Review. This specific article talks about the key to inclusive leadership, right? So the first part of the article describes six dimensions of inclusive leaders, and I'm just going to list them really quickly for the listeners. So it was visible commitment, which is making it clear that you're embracing inclusion. There was humility, which is you won't get it right the first time, and you acknowledge that you don't. You know, we have awareness of bias, which is you know your weaknesses, and you know the things that will kind of probably maybe fog your judgment. Curiosity about others. So genuinely wanting to learn more and being curious and diving deeper into concepts and ideas. There was cultural awareness, which was spotting and adapting to differences and perhaps even embracing them. And effective collaboration. So focusing on effective cohesion, empowering others and creating psychological safety nets and supports. I wanted to kind of get your opinion. Do you feel that these traits make sense? Are some more important than others? And are there any that really resonated with you or something perhaps you thought was even missing?
I think that the six dimensions of inclusive leaders from Burke and Titus, I think that it's a really good start to the conversation. I think, you know, that all of the factors that they said, I think they're important. But I think, you know, looking at oneself first is even more important. So looking at kind of the intersectional identity of the person, looking at, you know, factors such as race, gender, sexual orientation, age, disability, and looking at how people access power are also really critical. So yes, visual commitment is, you know, making clear that you're embracing inclusion is really important. But what is your definition of inclusion? I need to know. I think that's important to do so. Humility, it's really interesting that folks want people to have humility and do inclusive leadership. When folks who experience exclusion, usually their humility is being tampered with, right? So I think that when people say humility, are we talking about people who have power? Because this is about power. inclusion leadership is about power, sharing power, hopefully sharing power, and also, you know, breaking some of the barriers to power, or making, you know, power is abuse, kind of like checking that and hopefully making sure that doesn't happen. So I think humility is important, but who's having humility in part of the leadership, and who has access to this kind of notion of who can be acknowledged and not acknowledged? I think they're important, but I think it depends on the context. Who's the leader that we're talking about? Awareness of bias is really important. I also think that bias is really an important strength. I think it's important to know, like, I have a bias. I'll tell you, my bias is decolonizing, anti-colonial, anti-racist bias. That's my bias. And I go into it. When I teach, I come into the class and I say, this is the perspective that I'm going into. So I know that that bias is talking about other factors here, but I think we also have other biases, which are, you know, there are biases that can be, that are important to understand when we're trying to create inclusion. So I wonder about that, but I think it's still, you know, a good one. Curiosity about others, really, when I hear it, really what I think about it, if you want me to tell you the fully truth, it reminds me of multiculturalism. Like, that's like, you know, I think it's important to learn from others, right? And to have others be a part of the curiosity is interesting. Like, I don't feel like I'm curious about other folks. I feel like I can learn from other folks. I feel like I can engage in unlearning processes with people. So it's a different way of language. Cultural awareness, spotting and adapting to differences. Again, I would look at empathy, like cultural empathy, and how do we create cultural diverse knowledge within inclusive leadership? How do we bring different knowledges globally that maybe we can use to think differently about things in our world? An effective collaboration, I think, is a good one. You know, to do effective collaboration, we need to not only know each other, but we need to talk about power, unearned privilege, sharing power, resource sharing, cultural safety, cultural just work, etc. So overall, I think the article has some important factors, but I think, again, when you use certain words like inclusivity, what do we mean by that? How do we break it down more? Why can't we use words like creating or supportive power? How do we power share within inclusive leadership? Like, how do we also give up power for folks who have too much? How do we create empathetic and compassion-filled workplaces that really create inclusive understandings of difference, diversity, and anti-oppression practice? So that's kind of my short take on some of the thinking there.
Oh, that's a good take. And just to dig a little deeper into the article, it goes on to talk about the four actions of all leaders can take to increase their inclusive thinking tendencies. And maybe, as you talked about, the inclusive thinking is, how do we share that power? We talk about increase that empathy. So one, it talks about establishing a personal advisory board. So maybe this is from the community, the village that we've been talking about. And this community advisory board is really folks that can give you an honest critique and feedback of how you're doing with respect to your inclusive leadership. And then secondly, they talk about share and be open about your learning journey. So sharing the results of maybe it's a 360 or a discussion that you had with a specific person within that personal advisory board, a specific person within your village. And thirdly, talks about immersing yourself in unfamiliar and uncomfortable situations where you get to be exposed to more diverse stakeholders. So they're really looking at exploring these ideas because they're intended to foster more awareness, more empathy, and more perspective. And awareness of one's inclusiveness as a leader isn't sufficient. It can only be fostered if we are also empathetic and can gain that required perspective. So have you used any of these techniques? How did it go for you? If not, what are the other techniques that you use to foster this inclusive leadership?
Thank you. I actually like this part of the article. I like action-centered aspects of things. And I guess I've used community advisory boards, and I've had good and challenging experiences. So I've been on some community advisory boards or committees that really, they invite you for two meetings. They ask you to speak and they take your feedback, but you're not a part of the actual overall outcome. So those are ones that have kind of been challenging in, you know, different communities. They kind of take your knowledge, but not necessarily give you any credit for it, or sometimes even use it. Sometimes it's not used. So those are the ones that are not successful. But I'll give you an example of a successful one. In my Black Health COVID-19 research project, the community advisory board, it's local and global, about 10 to 20 folk from across Canada and across different global places and spaces. And that advisory committee was so responsible for like being able to get through, you know, COVID-19 research during COVID-19 in the Black community, which was a very stressful and grief, context of doing so. And they gave so much support, so much feedback, and were really involved in all of the processes of the research. So there can be times when, you know, it's not, I think, as effective, but there's times when it can definitely be not only useful, but really game-changing for doing the work. So it was a group of folks who were, you know, practicing from anti-racist, anti-oppression approaches from all disciplines and community leaders and all, you know, elders, et cetera. And just the inclusive, you felt like the village love that people said when they came to these meetings, right, that they felt the village love. And the work that we did together was just quite game changing for the research. So it can definitely be effective. I think sharing about one's journey is really important, but looking at your location, who's sharing, who's taking up space, who's allowed to share, who's not allowed to share, who's given care, who's given empathy in a group, who's not, is really important. Immersing oneself in unfamiliar or uncomfortable situations. It is never comfortable to challenge racism and other forms of oppression, particularly within our healthcare system. But I think it is critical to do the work. I feel nervousness. I feel, you know, not so good sometimes when I know I'm going to confront folks, but it's a part of what we need to do what I would say, you know, anti-racist, anti-oppression, in this case, it's calling it inclusive leadership. So I think these are some critical actions that are needed. I also think admitting when you're wrong, when you made a mistake, when you've been hurtful, when you have done something that causes pain, you also need to admit that in an inclusive leadership framework. Like, you need to be able to say, yo, I did this thing and it caused this and I'm sorry about it. That makes such a difference in trying to create an inclusive space. I also think you need to give up power for folks who are historically and currently have had power. You know, so if you're in a diverse group and you're trying to do solidarity work and you're doing, you know, there's white folks, Black folks, South Asian, Asian folks, Indigenous folks, folks who've had power need to be able to give up that power and be able to share that power and ask other people to lead, you know, have other folks be in the forefront. And when people give up power, giving up power doesn't mean that you leave people out to dry. You know what I'm trying to say? It's like you give them you still support. You're still in the background giving support. Folks who are in solidarity doing anti-racism, anti-oppression, who don't come from the communities that I come from, they're still doing the support work for myself to be able to do that work. They might not always be in the front, but doing solidarity work is to actually do the work. It's not to just say, I'm supporting you. You're going to be in the front and then you don't give nobody nothing, right? You don't give them resources. You don't give them hints. You don't give them empathy. You don't give them care. That's not support. Support is about care, empathy, love, understanding, resources, tools. You have to be able to tell me sometimes, hey, Roberta, this is what you did. This is not cool. You need to be able to tell me that. So next time I can make a change. If you really care about me, you're going to do that. So we really have to, I think about what that looks like in different ways.
I think even on both sides, it's learning how to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that we need to do. So those are the power of being vulnerable to give it up, because to be honest, anyone with the power, it would be scary to give it up, because what happens to me and then on the opposite end in terms of stepping into this room where you're the only one, in terms of, I feel that at times, so how do you speak up when you need to challenge something?
Yeah, but you have to, right? That's the, even if you're fearful though, that's the work, that's the internal power, empowerment that I have to do and you have to do and other folks who are doing leadership in this way. Even if we're frightened, even if we're scared, you still have to speak up, because you're not only speaking up for yourself, you're speaking up for communities. And it's about accountability, right? What's your accountability? That's what's also missing in this inclusive leadership article, or I think it needs to be strengthened. What is your accountability and responsibility to community right? And for folks that are being oppressed or being harmed within healthcare, within our health systems, or within our systems in general, what is our responsibility and accountability is to speak up, even though you're nervous. I'm often the only one. I'm often the one who's like, you know, speaking up and also experiencing violence at the same time, but still saying, I got to speak. I have to say this. I have to challenge you. I have to be able, you know, and being able to do that is a part of what we have to do as leaders, particularly in the context and the environment that we're living in now, to actually create changes.
This entire conversation has been so energizing, Robert, I have to tell you. Like, I've just been listening to what you're sharing, and it's a moment to hear, you know, someone who has been able to take all the energy that, you know, they have received over years and guide that in a way that is creating impact, change, fruition. It's been a privilege, and I'm really thankful to you know, listen to you and listen Thank to the you. Journey that you've kind of carved for yourself, and of course, those who are going to come after. We are near the end of the podcast, and at the end of the podcast, we tend to do this thing where it's called rapid fire. Now, rapid fire is a list of 5 questions that we're going to be asking you one after the other, and we hope to get an answer from you within under 5 seconds. And for perhaps, and so perhaps these are perhaps questions that, you know, they're a little bit about yourself, they're a little bit, you know, about the article, they're resource based, just to learn a little bit more about you and what drives you and gives you energy. And okay. So perhaps I'll start it off and we'll go from there. And so here's your first question. What is one book, movie, TV show, or podcast episode that comes to mind when you think of rebels and disruptors?
Color Purple. Love that movie, and was really had an impact on me in terms of just existing, by Alice Walker, the book Color Purple.
Amazing. Next question. Who is the greatest disruptor or rebel in your life?
My mom. My mommy, and she passed a couple of years ago. And as an ancestor, she's still kicking it. She's like, hey, you got to do this. You better get up. You better talk. You better Love move. It. Yeah.
Love that. Who is your dream instructor or guest lecturer for the MPH in Black Health program?
Oprah Winfrey. Come on now.
That's a good one. That's amazing. Hopefully
she's giving free cars too as well.
You get one. You get one. You get one.
Exactly. And West Hall. West Hall. I'd love to. Oh, yeah. I'd love to do some social economic health stuff. I think that there's so much that I'd like to do in that area. Yeah.
Amazing. Next question. What is one thing you do to foster humility?
I check myself a lot. I question how I am in the world on a daily. And that's just part of what I do. So I just make sure I check back, and I say sorry when I'm wrong, and I try to learn and unlearn something every day. I'm learning. I'm still learning, and I'm going to be learning until I'm an ancestor. I'm going to still be learning. Yeah.
Final question. This is the hardest one.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
Fill in the blank.
Uh-oh.
Rebels are.
Rebels are revolutionary. Rebels are right. Yes. Rebels are passion. Rebels have to live to stay in fight. Don't let me start getting poetic on you. Okay, because rebels is resistance. Rebels is persistence. Rebel is continuing to be persistent. That's what rebels are.
Love it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, Roberta. It's been such a pleasure. I think on a personal note, I think this entire conversation has been a moment for me to check myself where I am in my life. And, you know, if I'm able to fulfill the values, the dream of my answers and push it forward and drive them forward. So thank you so much. There are so many top moments that, you know, I'm going to have to listen to this episode again for myself just to like let it sit in. But, you know, prioritizing to speak under like intersectional trauma, you know, fighting the factors that are usually against humanity, understanding your character, analyzing when things are being applied to you, understanding your history, right? And there's a moment in this conversation where you said that, you know, it's 400 years of struggle. You need to, you know, sometimes rekindle and put yourself in that positioning and take that energy and drive it forward. I think we talked about neighborhoods and networks and support systems, and my favorite catchphrase of today's episode, village love.
Hello.
and all the way to using powerful tools and actionable items that we spoke about at the end of the episode. And at the end of the day, sometimes just offering a smile and hug in order to push the momentum forward.
100%.
Again,
I want to say something. I want to say I'm so proud of y'all. I'm really so proud of y'all, like the Build to Lead team. I just think, you know, what you're doing is about change. It's about resistance. It's about fierceness. And I just want to say, you know, congratulations. And as a village elder, which I am to you all, yes. You know, anytime you all need something or you please let me know, because I'm here. And I'm just really, really feeling the care and the passion and the love that you bring to the work that you do. And I know you guys are going to go and change this world. Y'all are going to change it. You will.
Yes. Thank you so much. Yeah. It was a complete joy to have you join us today.
Thank you.
And until next time. Thank you.
Thank you. Take good care.
Thank you for listening today. And thank you for joining us on Built to Lead Season 4, Rebels with a Cause. Built to Lead is created and hosted by Matthew Goldburn
and co-hosted by Mubin Lalani.
Built to Lead is a companion podcast to the Vernissage Health Dialogue Series at the Institute of Health Policy, Management and Evaluation at the University of Toronto.
Tell us what you thought about this week's episode. You can find us on LinkedIn at Vernissage Health and on Instagram at Vernissage Health. You'll find both of these in the episode description. Today's episode was produced by
Dheeraj Thakur,
Matthew Goldburn, with music composed by Sindhu.
A special thanks to Wendy Nelson, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Health Policy, Management and Evaluation. Until next time.